Casablanca. There we go. Casablanca. How many of you have seen Casablanca over the years? Oh, good, good. So most of you. Well, if you have never seen Casablanca, it is a romance released in 1942. There's all the important people who starred in it, lots of people. Bogart and Bergman, of course, the most famous. It is set in Casablanca, which is a seaport in southern France. This is during World War II, so it is what is called unoccupied France. That is, the parts of France where the Germans have not taken over. By this point, they've captured Paris and some other things. The interesting part of that, though, is that the German influence is still felt throughout unoccupied France, because it's pretty obvious that the French army can't stop them, and if the Germans wanted to take over unoccupied France, they can. And so there's a very uneasy balance of power where the Germans tell unoccupied France what to do, and unoccupied France, by and large, does it. Set against this backdrop, you have Humphrey Bogart, who plays Rick Blaine, who is an expatriate American. Evidently, we don't know why, but he cannot return to the United States. Bit of a man without a country. And he owns a nightclub in Casablanca. And just like the occupied French government and officials, in order to make his business work, he has to know whose hands to grease and which people to give deference to and all of that. Into his bar one night, or into his gin joint, as he favoritely says, of all the gin joints in all the world, she walked into mine, comes Ingrid Bergman, who plays Ilsa, whose last name is actually a bit of a mystery, so we'll just call her Ilsa. Evidently, when Rick had lived in Paris before the Germans invaded Paris, they had been an item, but she shows up in Rick's cafe with another guy, Victor Laszlo, who's actually a very famous freedom fighter who, we're told, has been in a concentration camp for a year but escaped and had been fleeing the Nazis and organizing resistance ever since. They need to get out of Casablanca. And lo and behold, Rick actually has the paperwork that will allow two people to get out of the country, but not three. So the decision is, will Rick take one of them? Will he go with his long-lost love, Ilsa? Or will he somehow help Victor Laszlo get out of the country? That's the basic synopsis of Casablanca. I don't mind sharing it with you too much because it's 70 years old. If you haven't seen it by now, it's not my fault. I don't feel like I'm giving anything away. So we might as well go to the end. At the end, Rick does everything like he's going to escape with Ilsa, except he gives both of those paperwork to Victor and to Ilsa, so allows them to escape on one of the last planes out of Casablanca. Rick actually shoots the head of the German police or whatever it is, army that's come to try and catch Victor Laszlo, and so he finds himself now a fugitive from Casablanca, as well as the French police lieutenant, which leads to one of the most famous lines at the end of the movie as they're about to run away, running for their lives, basically, when they say this could be the start of a beautiful friendship. For a variety of reasons. That's Casablanca. This morning's scripture story is a famous story about Jesus, where the Pharisees and the scribes come to Jesus and they try to trap him. They try to get him to say something either wrong against God or, more directly, wrong against the government so that he can be arrested and punished. And they think they've got it. They think they've got it. They ask him, really, really wise, religious, fair teacher, should we even bother to pay taxes? After all, we know it's the empire is corrupt. You know, every government's corrupt. Should we even bother? God doesn't want money. And so Jesus gets out of it. How? He says, look at the money you hold in your hands. Whose money is it? The emperor's. Fair enough. Not God's to start with. It's interesting. One more parallel between the movie and that story. just to start with, it's fair to say that the Roman Empire had kind of the same power over its vassal states as the Germans did in occupied and even unoccupied Europe during the 30s and the 40s. So there's a parallel there about this kind of corrupt power system that touches and taints everything it comes into contact with. The other interesting parallel between the stories, I hadn't noticed until we watched the movie again on Wednesday night, and the same way the Pharisees tried to trap Jesus is the same way the French try to trap Rick over these papers that nobody knows he has, but everybody knows he has, and everybody's trying to get. You know, with Jesus, the Pharisees come up and say, "Now, wise teacher, we know you're fair. You don't play favorites. You're the fairest guy we know. So we got a question for you." If you remember in Casablanca, the people who are after this government paperwork do the same thing to Rick. "Rick, we know. You don't play favorites. We don't understand. You don't play all the games that everybody else does to get by, and yet you get through. You're the fairest guy we know in Casablanca. Now about that paperwork that you don't have. If somebody might want to buy it from you, I mean, because you're fair, I imagine you're just going to take the highest bidder." Both of them are traps. A lot of times people try to trap us by buttering us up one way or another. But I didn't really want to focus on that this morning, though it is an interesting parallel that I had not recognized between the two stories when I chose the stories to go together. Instead, I want to focus at what's at issue in both of these, the film and in this incident from Jesus' ministry, this kind of corrupting influence of this all-powerful force that overwhelms everybody. With the Romans had all the power. Their armies were the best in the world, at least where the Middle East was, and controlled everything. They had developed infrastructure to help do things. They had developed elaborate road systems, elaborate postal services for the age, elaborate systems of government. In fact, you had kind of had overlapping layers of government because the Romans were practical. When they conquered people, they wanted the people to sort of maintain their identity because they thought they would be easier to manage if they did. Like the Germans did with some, not all, but with some of their conquests in Europe. And so the Romans would recognize certain government officials that were already there, which is where King Herod comes, or the King Herods. There are actually several Herods during Jesus' lifetime that were king. That's where they come from. Those are the Jewish authorities. But as you might remember in the crucifixion story, it's not exactly clear how much authority they have because the Romans also send out other officials to keep tabs on them. And there are Roman armed forces stationed in Jerusalem on the Temple Mount, right around the corner from the temple, and elsewhere in the Holy Land, and elsewhere throughout the empire. Just to keep an eye on everything. The Germans did the same thing. The people they didn't like, they rounded up and they put to the side, and several of them they slaughtered. The others, they tried to let have certain small amounts of freedom because it made them docile, but there was always the threat that they could be on the chopping block next. In Casablanca, what does this mean? Well, you have this beautiful love story between the two people right there in the picture, between Rick and Ilsa. But forces beyond them keep them from being together. Because it turns out that Ilsa actually has always been married to Victor, even when she and Rick had their liaison in Paris. It seems good to use the French word as long as they were in Paris, right? She never would have been with Rick in the first place if she had not been separated from her husband when he was thrown in a concentration camp and run for her own life. And then when they reconnected, she couldn't be with, she had two men that she loved. And she really didn't want to pick either, but she couldn't be with both of them. Love, we tend to think, is a pretty pure emotion, and most of the time it is. But here we have a pure emotion, or a relatively pure emotion, that's corrupted by this external force, right? Her love with her husband is broken up. She imagines that, like most people, he's going to die in the concentration camp. So when she finds another man that she falls in love with, she allows that relationship to progress. It's amazing, actually, in a couple of the scenes, how far it evidently progressed. I didn't know it could progress that far in a 40s movie, but didn't leave too much to the imagination. But then that, because the Germans come in, that relationship gets broken up by the Germans as well. And then all three of them come together, fearing for their lives and their safety in Casablanca. And the fact of the matter is, none of them can be happy. You see that? None of them can be happy. Because Victor now knows that his wife was with another man, and she still has feelings with it for him. Rick now knows that the woman that he fell in love with in Paris is already married, and lo and behold, has showed up with her husband. And Ilsa loves two men and knows she can't be with both of them. I don't feel quite so bad for Ilsa's. Yeah. What a terrible choice. You're in love with two people. Most of us would settle for one. Oh, well. That's another sermon. Pastors shouldn't bring their stuff into the sermon. I'm sorry. We'll come back. Now I've distracted myself. Anyway, the same thing is true, I think, on a larger scale in the story with Jesus. That these outside forces are corrupting good impulses within the Jewish people. And in fact, the Jewish people had made all sorts of concessions to the Romans so that the Romans didn't kill them and wipe them out completely. All sorts of concessions, including, yes, letting the Roman garrison station itself on the Temple Mount. If you think that was a happy concession, the only thing they could do was keep them out of the Holy of Holies. That was the trade-off. Don't go in the sanctuary. But you can be on the Temple Mount and you can be in the temple courtyard. They would patrol there, evidently. They made other concessions. I mean, Herod had no real claim to the throne when he took over, but he had the Roman support. So the other Jewish leaders kind of fell in line. Of course, the temple leadership was corrupted anyway because the Romans, through the puppet, got to rubber stamp whoever the high priest was going to be. Needless to say, the high priest was then inclined to listen very carefully to what Rome had to say. And this is in religious matters. And of course, it filters out in other ways. Morality, do you follow the Jewish teaching, the teaching of God, or do you follow the prevailing culture around yourself and get along? Do you go along to get along? And a lot of times the Jews went along to get along. They tried to identify certain things that they just wouldn't budge on. The sanctuary, the Holy of Holies is God's room. You can't go in there unless you're the high priest. They still collected the temple tax in temple money. They were allowed to keep currency for the temple, not for the rest of the nation, but for the temple. They were allowed to worship their God openly. To sacrifice openly. Of course, that causes other concerns with Jesus and other parts of the story about how they did that, but how they sold those animals and how they charged a user fee, basically, or an exchange, thank you. An exchange fee for when you would change your Roman denarii into temple currency so you could pay your temple tax. All these things. And I imagine that Jesus probably would have looked at these people and said, look, none of what you're doing is exactly what God wants you to do. Not any of it. not any of it. If you want to live perfect lives as God intended you to live, you cannot live them under Rome. But in fairness, I don't think Jesus expected them to just run away and try somewhere else. I think Jesus recognized they just couldn't. The Roman influence was so corrupting, so pervasive, they couldn't live perfect lives. They had to deal with the Roman money, because that's how you would buy bread. That's how you'd buy animals. That's how you'd pay your taxes. You had to use the Roman roads, the Roman water system, the Roman postal service. Some of them had to serve in the Roman armed forces. But then again, we kind of face some of the same things. We don't see it quite as pervasive, and we don't see it as quite as oppressive, but we face some of the same things. In order to get by in this country, you have to make money. Even if you are a subsistence farmer in the middle of Montana, you have to make some money because you will owe taxes, even in the middle of Montana. And there are probably some things that you will not be able to provide for yourself, even in the middle of Montana. So we make concessions, right? We do what we need to do in order to make the paycheck so that we can pay the bills. Hopefully, we do it in an upstanding and ethical way, but we don't do it perfectly. We just can't. Because our financial system ultimately rests on this fact. The better of a deal that you can get, the more money you will have. And that goes across the board. The better of a deal that you can get on a loaf of bread at the store, the more money you'll have to spend on other things. The better of a deal you can make when you negotiate your contract for a job. The better of a deal you can get when you negotiate to buy a house or rent a house. The better of a deal that you can get. And somewhere along the line, and frankly, most of us know this because we feel it, many places along the line, people get pinched in that system. People don't make enough at their jobs. People spend too much on groceries and gas and taxes and fill in the blank. Insurance, thank you. Yes, yeah, insurance. Don't the insurance agents drive nice cars, though? But they get pinched, too. Doctors make a lot of money. They get pinched. There are very few people in our culture that don't get pinched financially. Oh, and the other thing, we've learned in the last 150 years that time is money. So it's not just what we spend our money on, but we recognize that our time is a commodity. And sometimes we budget and we spend our time the same ways we budget and spend money. And we make the same compromises. We talk about, Lord help us, our great-great-great-grandparents would never have said the following. Quality time with our kids. Quality time with our grandkids. What in the world are you talking about? And I don't say that because that's what we cherish, the quality time we can have with people, because we're all so busy and we're so spread out. So don't let me think that I'm saying we also know deep down that's not the way it's supposed to be, is it? That's not God's way. It's the system we've grown up into, and I don't think any of us individually, or even a small group of us, could change it. So we got to figure out how much do we put up with, and where do we draw the line? The truth of the matter is, we make compromises, and sometimes we make guesses, and we look for what we hope is the best outcome, and we do what it takes to get to that best outcome. Even if it means we cut a couple corners. Even if it means we recognize this was not the perfect way to get to this solution. We do it in large ways as governments and corporations. You try to find peace in the Middle East. Feel free. They're going to buy and barter and steal and lie and do whatever it takes to try and just get them to stop shooting at one another for 24 hours. They haven't been able to do it yet. We've passed the perfect. We passed the perfect a long time ago. Now they're just looking for what will work. But we don't have to go across the world to find that problem. We can go to Washington, D.C. or Jeff City or any state or federal government right now. They don't work. And I think we've given up on the perfect solution. We just want to find a solution to get them to do something productive. But we don't even have to go that far away. Many of you in this room have kids. Some have grandkids or great-grandkids. And you know when you're raising kids, you start off with the best intentions of how you are going to raise your child or your children. But there comes a point, usually after the fifth sleepless night, where you don't care about the perfect. You just want them to do X, Y, and Z. You just want them to eat at a certain time, whatever it takes. You just want them to sleep for 2 hours, any 2 hours. Any 2 hours. It doesn't matter. We're no more of this trying to schedule their sleeping. Any 2 hours. And they get older and you get tired. You don't care what they play with as long as it doesn't have sharp edges. It doesn't have to be a toy. Yes, all the kitchen stuff is fair game as long as it's not a knife. Please, empty the cabinets, go through the sheets, tear up the clothes. We don't care as long as you're not going to hurt you. It's not the perfect. It's what gets us through the day. And I do that as a kind of funny way to just point out that's not the only place we do that in our day-to-day lives. We make those compromises, those guesses all the time. Sometimes, in the grand scheme of things, they're probably not all that important. But maybe they are. But a movie like Casablanca, and certainly this story with Jesus this morning about paying money to the emperor or not, reminds us that we don't really have the option of living perfectly. We make these concessions. Sometimes we get faced with terrible choices. I don't believe Jesus ever sinned a day in his life. But ultimately, there came a day where he could not make a concession to the Roman authority, and he paid for it with his life. Or I think about occupied and unoccupied France. I think about the Third Reich. And I think about one of the most famous theologians of the 20th century named Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who wrote passionately and powerfully about how you live faithfully in troubled times. Very honest, very powerful, very faithful stuff. And yet Bonhoeffer, by the mid-40s, well, by 1943, had associated himself with other people actively trying to assassinate Adolf Hitler because he decided that murder was justified because of the possible outcome. He had left the perfect. The perfect wasn't an option under the Third Reich. And he decided that that sin was still a sin, but that sin was better than a host of other sins that were being committed. But the truth of the matter is, it's a gamble. It's a guess. Some days it's a stab in the dark about what's important and what's not. And more to the point, whether our attempts to get to the end result will work or not. Casablanca is such a fun movie and I think such an enduring movie because it works out in the end. Well, no, Rick, they don't get to be together. How does it work out in the end? Well, the leading German gets shot. Hooray. But yes, it's a cheering moment. Rick shoots the German major. Ilsa and her husband Victor get on the plane and get out to safety. We see the plane take off into the air and get away. Rick is still alive and not under arrest, and the policeman who might arrest him realizes that if he arrests him, he's going to get arrested too, so they both are going to get out. Evidently, Rick has sold his bar. He's got enough money to finance their escape. It's not a perfect ending, but it's a happy ending. Somehow it works out. Somehow the imperfect plans and plots and greasing the right hands and is going to get it to the best possible outcome. Not a perfect outcome, but the best possible outcome. I think as people of faith, we look for those best possible outcomes. Sometimes our choices are pretty bleak. Another 20th century theologian, Reinhold Niebuhr, talked about governments, particularly during the Cold War, and the choices were between bad and worse. The choices that the government faced were not to not sin. It was to either sin a little or sin a lot. And so he advocated as a theologian, given that choice, you should just sin a little. But I think that's comparable in our own lives. Some days we're faced with choices where we can sin a little or we can sin a lot. We like to imagine that we can be perfect. Okay, you can imagine that. But we can't. We can sin a little, or we can sin a lot. I think we should celebrate more of the good things or the sinning just a little that we do, and then focus on the sinning a lot that we do. I've never met anybody who thought they were perfect at forgiving other people. But I have met people who have forgiven someone else for something truly awful that they suffered. They didn't forgive everybody, but they were able to forgive somebody that I don't know if I could have forgiven. We should celebrate that, not call them a hypocrite because they didn't forgive everybody else too. The same with love. I've seen many people who are in love or who love their kids or who love their neighbors, in fact, may go two or three steps beyond in how they treat others. But you know it and I know it. They still have moments where they don't, and they still have people they don't get along with. They love some people, including some people it's genuinely difficult to love, but they don't love everybody. And so sometimes we say, hypocrite. Or maybe we should just recognize we're all stuck in this system. It's what Paul calls sin. For all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. He writes in Romans, that's what that means. We're all tainted. We're all imperfect. I think our choices are to celebrate the good, or at least the not God-awful. Or we can just say, well, we can just throw up our hands and say the whole system's shot. But the question then is, if we do that, what do you do next? Because you can't get away from the system. Or as people in my generation say, or the generation before mine too, you can't get away from the man. The man will follow you. The man will find you. At the very least, the man will take the tax money. Even if you think you can get away from it with death. No, the man comes for your money then too. This isn't a very uplifting sermon. I have failed. It's an honest sermon. This is what you've just bought yourself a ticket for, John. But I hope it's encouraging, because the truth is, we've all made mistakes. The truth is, every day, we all make more mistakes. Our goal as people of faith, it seems to me, is not to be perfect, because I just don't think that's possible until we get to the next kingdom. I do think it is possible that we make fewer mistakes, that we make less stupid mistakes, and that we hopefully make less malicious, hurtful mistakes. I think Jesus would be pleased with that. I think he would recognize it's not perfect. And if we went to Jesus and tried to get Jesus to say, is this perfect? Jesus would honestly say, no. If we went to Jesus like that rich young ruler and said, is this enough? Jesus would honestly say, no. But I do think that Jesus would say, but it's better today than it was yesterday. You're doing better today than you did last week. And we hope to do better still tomorrow. Enough, yes. Amen.